I'm Brooke Gladstone with a podcast extra. President Obama is in Japan, and he'll visit Hiroshima, the first sitting U.S. president to do so, to deliver a speech about the U.S. bombing of that city and of Nagasaki. We immediately remembered two relevant stories we did a few years back that we really liked, so here they are for your listening pleasure. In the late morning of August 9, 1945, U.S. Air Force Major Charles Sweeney flew a B-29 bomber into an overcast sky above southern Japan. During a break in the cloud cover, he released his payload, a 10,000-pound atomic bomb codenamed Fat Man, which fell for more than a minute before exploding over the port city of Nagasaki. Tens of thousands of civilian Japanese died immediately.
The atomic bombs which fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki must be made a signal, not for the old process of falling apart, but for a new era, an era of ever closer unity and ever closer friendship among peaceful nations.
President Truman spoke at the Navy Day celebration in New York City in October 1945. By that time, many thousands more Japanese were dying of a mysterious disease. But journalists were barred from the affected areas, so few accounts of the suffering would reach readers here at home. In fact, the very first reporter on the scene, George Weller, wrote a series of articles that were never published until 2005, when his son found old carbon copies in his home after he died. I asked author Greg Mitchell about George Weller, who he was, and how did he manage to get into Nagasaki and get the story?
Well, Weller was a celebrated war correspondent for the old Chicago Daily News. He was in Tokyo with other reporters who came in early September, and they were told by General MacArthur's headquarters not to go anywhere near Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and most of the reporters went along with that. But Weller, wanted the scoop, and so by hook or by crook, he made his way to the southern island of Kyushu, where Nagasaki's located. He got in the area, pretending he was covering an old kamikaze camp, and somehow wandered into Nagasaki almost exactly a month after the atomic bombing.
So he was the first reporter on the ground. The articles never made it to print. So what happened to them?
Well, he made the mistake of filing them through General MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo. More than a dozen, certainly, over the course of 2 or 3 weeks. He thought that because they were not sensationalistic, they would get out, and they never did. He lost track of the carbons. It was an almost 60-year mystery of what was in them, what happened to them.
But the carbons were found in his home in Italy after he died, and they were published for the first time last month in a Japanese newspaper. Let me read the first sentence of the first of the four articles. It's datelined September 8th, 1945. Quote, "The atomic bomb may be classified as a weapon capable of being used indiscriminately, but its use in Nagasaki was selective and proper and as merciful as such a gigantic force could be expected to be." Does this strike you as something of an odd tone for a news account from a war zone?
Well, of course, you have to remember this was at the end of World War II, and Weller and other correspondents had seen a great deal of death in the preceding years, and the atomic bomb seemed to be just a bigger blast, just a bigger bomb, because not much was known about radiation. And in fact, that's why MacArthur did not want people to go to these cities. That's why U.S. officials, starting then and going on for years and decades, did not want people to focus on the properties of the bomb that made it different.
Because they knew and no one else did.
That's right. So Weller's initial reaction changed when he actually went into the hospitals. And literally, the same day he wrote that, later in that day, he wrote a quite different account after seeing the patients in the hospitals dying a month after the blast.
Can you describe what he wrote about when he went to those hospitals and saw the impact of the bomb?
Well, he saw women and children and other civilians who were lying on the floor or lying on beds with the hair falling out with strange red spots all over them, in terrible shape. He called this Disease X because the doctors didn't quite know what it was. There were rumors about radiation. The little that people knew about radiation disease, this seemed to be it. And so he wrote about these people, and his second and third accounts that came out of Nagasaki were quite different.
And that last piece he wrote ends with a statement that Americans are due to arrive in Nagasaki to study the bomb site. And he then writes, quote, "Japanese hope that they will bring a solution for Disease X." Do you think if Weller hadn't discussed Disease X in that piece, that maybe it wouldn't have been censored?
It's hard to say because there was a clampdown on virtually everything going on surrounding these two cities. A day or two after he got there, the military brought in a small group of other war correspondents for a short tour, and their stories were then held up and were censored. And the accounts that they gave focused on the blast and focused on what had happened in the cities, with no mention of dying people in the hospital.
Greg, you co-wrote a book titled Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial. What was most remarkable for you when you read these accounts for the first time?
Well, I think it was how Weller himself symbolized or represented the whole American and world experience with the bomb. There was his initial elation, in a way, seeing the effects of the bomb and how it may have produced the end of the war, and it was almost triumphal. But then when he learned, and then later the world learned, of the very special properties of this bomb and the fact that its poisons could be spread for many miles and even threaten the end of the world eventually, he had a very different outlook. He never became a real anti-nuker, but his whole experience, just in a little nutshell there in a few days, really captured a lot of what the American experience was in responding to the bomb.
Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Mitchell is a journalist and the author of many books. You can find him at his blog, Pressing Issues.
Weller's accounts languished in storage until 2005, but the New York Times had its own reporter on the atomic beat. William L. Lawrence wasn't ever on the ground in Japan. Instead, the Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer was a proto-embed flying above Japan when the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. It was extraordinary access. And Lawrence also had observed the atomic bomb's manufacture and testing. His 10-part series profiling the bomb would win him and the Times that Pulitzer in 1946. But until the bombs fell, Lawrence protected another piece of intelligence. He had been on the payroll of the U.S. War Department. David Goodman wrote about Lawrence in Exception to the Rulers, a book he co-authored with his sister Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!
Lawrence was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. He was a science reporter for the Times. He won his first Pulitzer Prize in 1937, and he became a staunch advocate of the atomic bomb long before the atomic bomb was ever dropped. Throughout the 1930s, he was advocating for research into the use of atomic power, such that he earned a nickname, Atomic Bill.
So when the War Department was looking explicitly for a working newspaperman to help mold public opinion about the bomb, natural choice.
Indeed. General Leslie Groves was the military director of the Manhattan Project, scientists who researched and created the bomb. His own words were that he was looking for a, quote, suitable newspaperman to tell the story of the bomb to the public, to put the language of this arcane science into lay people's terms. So in March 1945, there was an extraordinary secret meeting held at the offices of the New York Times in which General Groves came to meet with William Lawrence and ask that he become a special consultant to the War Department.
David, there is one brief passage in a piece by Lawrence as he flew on the plane that was about to drop the bomb on Nagasaki that is an astonishing window into his frame of mind. Can you read that for me, please?
What Lawrence wrote was that he felt no, quote, pity or compassion for the poor devils who were about to die. And he went further because his compassion was reserved for the bomb itself. When the bomb detonated, quote, awestruck, we watched it shoot upward like a meteor coming from the earth instead of from outer space, becoming ever more alive as it climbed skyward through the white clouds. It was a living thing, a new species of being, born right before our incredulous eyes.
Now, the story goes beyond Lawrence reporting with an obvious conflict of interest about the dropping of the bomb. it gets far more sordid because when the news of radiation disease began to leak out, the War Department went into full defensive mode and used Lawrence to publish, in effect, disinformation. Tell me about that.
General Groves handpicked a group of journalists to accompany him not to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but to the bomb site out in New Mexico, where the first bomb was detonated. And it was there that William Lawrence wrote what General Groves had wanted him to write. Lawrence, quoting General Groves, writes, "The Japanese claim that people died from radiation. If this is true, the number was very small." Lawrence continues in his own editorializing in the story. He writes, quote, "The Japanese are still continuing their propaganda aimed at creating the impression that we won the war unfairly and thus attempting to create sympathy for themselves in milder terms. Thus, at the beginning, the Japanese described symptoms that did not ring true."
60 years later, the dropping of the bomb remains one of the great historical controversies. What I find so stunning about this is that at the contemporaneous moment when the world had to make up its mind, the New York Times, in effect, became a propaganda tool of the U.S. government. And for this, William L. Lawrence and the New York Times were awarded a Pulitzer Prize.
That's right. And the very debate that you allude to about, was the atomic bomb an appropriate response? Well, Americans really wouldn't know if they don't know the reality of what happened on the ground. In our book, we call for William Lawrence's Pulitzer Prize to be stripped. I think that this story has some very important modern parallels, certainly in the case of the Iraq War and in the case of the New York Times with the, I would say, credulous, uncritical reporting of Judith Miller, among others. Anytime we see the drums of war, we should really be looking to journalists to challenge those in power, not to become a megaphone for those in power.
Well, David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
David Goodman is co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them. You've been listening to an On the Media podcast extra. If you aren't already signed up to get our weekly newsletter, I urge you to go to our website and subscribe as soon as you can. Not only is it a very fun read and a good way to stay up to date with what's happening with OTM, but in June, we're planning some really good giveaways that you'll be entered for if you're a subscriber. Thanks, everybody. I'm Bob Garfield.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.